imperative to look back historically, and in particular, since after the Islamic Revolution in Iran in 1979, the United States of America has worked using the same tactic, that is divide and conquer, to expand its influence in West Asia through British-made radical groups, also supported by it and with American Arab facilitation. To discuss this issue with us from Tehran is Dr. Mustafa Khoshashm, academic and political commentator. Thank you for being with us, Mr. Khoshashm. Now, Iran's enemies tried concealing their role as real motivators, actors, and organizers of forming an extremist and sectarian front against the Islamic Republic and maintaining the secrecy of both American and Israeli support to terrorists who attempted to ignite Iran. Yet the Islamic Republic was able to dissect those behind the sabotage and expose the Western hegemony. What do you think Iran's next move will be?
This is a scheme that has been repeated and that has been underway by the United States. Whenever Iran and the United States are at a willpower, a war of willpower, then the Americans start a pretty known and notorious formula against Iran that includes hybrid warfare. In more than a dozen areas, they try to fight against Iran indirectly in different areas of media, of foreign currency, of oil supplies to the foreign countries, as well as at international bodies through terror and assassination and so on and so forth, in order to push Iran back. This actually started under President Obama. But it has always been at work whenever there has been, some kind of resistance from the side of the Iranians. The last time that we experienced this war of willpower was in the spring, when Iran and the United States were over a couple of issues remaining under the JCPOA talks, in the JCPOA talks. And then in spring, the first round of this war of willpower started. The formula, the consequence, and the sequence actually of each move to be made by the United States is pretty well known. Even the duration of each move is known. It always starts with a number of what I call conspiracy theories, like Iran wants to assassinate this and that guy, wants to kidnap this and that guy, and then wants to explode this place or that place. They don't mean to really prove anything at court or at international bodies. They just mean to damage Iran's reputation for the next stage. The next stage is actually targeting the Iranian public opinion, and that's what I call a war of perception or cognition. Then they try to misrepresent the situation. Like in this round of the second round of war willpower, before Mahsa Amini's story developed, when she was alive, they started lies about the life and death of the Iranian supreme leader. It's not just about Iranian opposition TVs. We're also talking about New York Times and many others who claim the Iranian supreme leader's health conditions is aggravating, that they even alleged that he has already died. For five consecutive days, they promulgated this lie, because when you do that, then those that support the Islamic Republic grow concerns, and then those who want to start rioting or anything like that, they are encouraged and provoked, and they see some kind of hope for their movement.
Well,
then the next
if I may, Mr. Khoshashm, it's as you said, it's some sort of a hybrid war on many fronts and multiple fronts. And one of the most important fronts that they have been using ever since the Islamic Revolution was the industrial slowdown, accelerating the trend towards establishing regional monetary or banking blocks, fragmenting global trade, dismantling the global economy, especially the economy around Iran, as methods of instability and of also using corruption, until reaching some sort of Iranian fragmentation or dismantling of the Islamic Republic inside of Iran. But why has this plan not achieved its goal yet, despite the fact that it has been in place since 1979?
Well, first of all, let me complete this complete process. One aspect, one of the areas that deal with is exactly what you said. I mean, simultaneous with rioting, they go for cyber attacks, massive cyber attacks. And then when you deal with rioting, according to all internationally recognized and acceptable and endorsed protocols, then they start, imposing sanctions, human rights sanctions on you, claiming that you have killed this one or that one, as if no one is killed in the United States during riotings. Only in this year, some 700 people have been killed by the police, not in rioting, but just in everyday life. The police has killed 700 people. The same happens in other countries. Errors, mistakes happen everywhere. But when you are the targeted nation, they don't care if one-third of those that have been killed in this rioting have been from the besieged IRGC and law enforcement police forces. One-third. That's a lot. That means that you don't want to kill the population. As a matter of fact, you are coming under attack, but they don't consider that. Then they go for sanctioning you to, damage your reputation again. Then they go for foreign currency meddling in your economy to disturb the market, destabilize the market. Next move, disturbing the flow of your oil supplies to the foreign customers. Mm-hmm. Next move, using Mossad for terror, assassination, sabotage at nuclear industries like what happened in spring. Then they use IAEA or other international bodies to levy pressure, political and diplomatic pressure on you. The last step is a military threat, but of course the United States has not been powerful in the last 1.5 years to pose any kind of threat. So this time Biden came to the region with four goals and objectives. The first one was this, that if you don't sign the treaty, the JCPOA, then I will start a coalition of Arabs and Israelis to, confront you, because they are leaving, the Americans are being expelled from the region. Mm-hmm. They are afraid that what could happen with regard to Iran's regional growth. So this is a formula. They started this again after the Vienna talks, exactly. The conspiracy theories, the war of perception, rioting, cyber attacks, disturbing Iran's oil flow, foreign currency meddling, human rights, sanctions, mm-hmm. and then terror at Shahjarah, and then sabotage. They've been doing that. They've been trying a lot. The Evin prison was one of the many cases that they tried to do sabotage. And then next week, you will see they are going to, level up their threats at the IAEA. So this is a known formula.
Well,
Iran
in
has
1 minute,
out.
Mr. Mustafa, we have one more minute left for the segment. How do you think Iran's official next step would be when you explain everything, all kinds of warfare that the West is trying against Iran? How do you think Iran will face all this?
Well, Iran has learned a lot in the last 1 or 2 decades, especially ever since Obama started this kind of formula against Iran. And they have worked out pretty well defenses in each and every area, not only diffusing their moves, but also reciprocating their moves. Mm-hmm. In overall words, I can say whatever they've done to Iran, the moves have not remained unanswered. But this is just the reaction. There is also active part which will come, like the Saudis, that's part of actually this coalition under the Abraham Accord, that they say that they have not signed it, but they are collaborating with the Israelis under the American schemes. They are supporting the terrorist organization, Iran International. We call it Saudi International, as a matter of fact. And also they have been funding all the operations in foreign currency meddling, everything. Mm-hmm. And the Israelis have been conducting this. So the Saudis are going to pay for that. And mm-hmm. that's a kind of active move that Iran is going to make. Of course, this is not going to necessarily be direct action, military action. It could come in a variety of ways.
Definitely. But Israel, and we have seen Iran previously try and deal with such a situation, especially with regional countries like Saudi Arabia and others. Unfortunately, that's all the time that we have for this segment. Thank you very much. From Tehran, Dr. Mustafa Khoshesh, academic and political commentator, for showing us the scene inside of Iran. Now, please stay tuned, because next we will be talking about something called a sham elections in Bahrain.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Bahraini opposition forces announced a constitutional document in which they affirmed their striving for a new constitution for Bahrain and boycotted the country's elections. Now, the Bahraini opposition considers that the constitution enforced in the country since 2002 is imposed on the people, and it came as a coup against the first contractual constitution that was actually drawn up in election constituent assembly in 1973. Sham elections in Bahrain in this following report.
What happened in Bahrain during the election season was unfamiliar in the modern-day countries of the world, where the authorities are striving to pass their democratic carnival to which foreigners are also invited, while the citizens who own the land are neglected and excluded from the elections by royal decisions. Bahraini King Hamad bin Isa ensured his control over the entire 2022 electoral process, from its management to supervision and scheduling of lists of those entitled to run for office and vote. This control is evident when examining the electoral bloc in Bahrain. Recalling the numbers of previous rounds, it appears that voters in 2006 were about 295,000, while in 2010 they reached about 318,000. And the number rose in 2014 to 349,000, until it became in 2018 about 365,000. But this year it decreased to 349,000 according to announced official statistics. Logic says that the numbers of the electoral bloc increase proportionally every 4 years due to the demographic nature. But this year, this increase was not recorded, not because of a human or demographic imbalance, but because the system found this increase in voter statistics rise is harmful to the current regime. Accordingly, Al-Khalifa inclined towards the option of exclusion. So they worked on adjusting the numbers to suit their odds and be in favor of the regime's ballot boxes. In 2018, ahead of the parliamentary elections, the king issued a law amending Article 3 of the Decree on Exercising Political Rights, as a result of which some 80,000 members of dissolved political societies like Al-Wifaq, Islamic Action and Wad were removed from the electoral process. The law is still in force today, but the regime was not satisfied with banishing opponents to this extent, as it completed the policy of cancellation by removing more eligible voters this year too. 37,000 Bahrainis were simply eliminated from the voter registry. They were eligible citizens who chose to boycott the 2018 elections, even though their motives are not the same, which could be either for a political stance or due to illness or even travel. When calculating the size of the isolated bloc, it will be evident that the families of those who are prohibited from voting were also not allowed to participate in the polling day. Practically, the Bahraini Authority removed a quarter of the voters from its lists, and this undoubtedly indicates that there is an imbalance in the real representation of the people, meaning that the entire process lacks transparency and credibility as per international laws and norms. The foregoing confirms that the Al-Khalifa regime wants to uproot the people who oppose its policy. Rather, the act amounts to the uprooting of opponents. Bahraini opposition members view this as a harsh eradication that they are subjected to in their homeland in exchange for granting nationalities to foreigners and aliens.
To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is lawyer Ibrahim Sarhan, legal advisor and human rights defender. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Sarhan. So Bahrain went ahead and did an election last week with 37,000 Bahrainis simply eliminated from the voters' registry, added to the 80,000 that the regime had already eliminated before. Is that election a legal, a legitimate one that represents the people of Bahrain?
The elections that happened this year in Bahrain occurred while illegally eliminating 93,000 eligible voters from the voter registry. This elimination and political isolation was possible due to the act of confiscating the popular will, which began in 1975, when the king back then froze the 1973 parliament. Bahrain gained its independence in 1971, and then the Emir of Bahrain, Sheikh Isa bin Khalifa, vowed during his first speech that this independence will provide freedoms for the people of Bahrain and promised that the people will be the source of power in the country. The first constituent assembly was elected due to the draft constitution in 1971-1972, and the people of Bahrain voted for this constitution. As a result, the 1973 parliament came to be, but 2 years after the work of this parliament, it was frozen due to the so-called state security law, the law that the people of Bahrain objected to through parliament. And from that moment, that is, since 1975 on, there has been no popular will and no constitutional institution that expresses the will of the people of Bahrain. In 1999, when the emir died, the king came along and transformed the emirate into a kingdom and came up with the National Action Charter, which came in order to end the dignity uprising that occurred in the 90s. But this charter also stated that in the legislative authority there are two chambers, an appointed assembly and an elected assembly. All of these assemblies also failed to be adhered to by the King of Bahrain. The King tried to make Parliament work according to its own size, so that it would have 18 seats for the opposition and 22 seats for his loyalists. Nevertheless, according to the distribution of these seats, there are discrepancies of more than 500%. For example, the electorate bloc in the opposition constituencies would be about 10,000 or 16,000. While the loyalist bloc constituencies does not exceed 2,000 or 3,000 votes, so that there would always be a huge difference in between both constituencies.
Mr. Khan,
the thing that you're saying is that it is not only illegal, it does not definitely represent the people of Bahrain and the population of Bahrain. But we did see that there was a boycott from the opposition. For example, Al-Wifaq National Islamic Society issued a booklet containing 139 reasons to boycott what they called as the sham parliamentary elections that the regime conducted in Bahrain. Why not support opposition candidates instead of boycotting the elections, Mr. Ibrahim?
When the National Action Charter was implemented and the constitution of the Kingdom of Bahrain in 2002 came to be unilaterally by the king himself, the opposition boycotted the first elections in 2022 due to the king's reneging of the covenant and its transgression of the popular will. In 2006, there were advices that the opposition go through the election experience to improve the situation or to pursue change from within this incompetent parliament. But this experiment in 2006 and 2010 did not bring encouraging results to continue. Therefore, the opposition withdrew in 2011 and the February 14 revolution began, after which three electoral experiments came through which the opposition did not take part in. The reason for the boycott is the deep problem associated with the Bahraini constitution. This problem cannot be resolved through parliament. There must be a serious intent by the King of Bahrain to change this constitution and to return the constitution to the popular will. It is not possible for this illegitimate institution to come up with a reform of the constitution of the Kingdom of Bahrain, which is based on Article 33, which gives absolute authority and allows the king to change the constitution himself. The problem is deeper than the election process. Because these elections are a sham and comic in a dictatorial regime with absolute power that neither the elections nor any of the constitutional institutions can change. There needs to be pressuring tools, and that's what we think will happen. We believe that in every generation there is a revolution inside Bahrain, and we believe that things are not promising to calm the situation in Bahrain. Rather, we expect that there will be an upcoming uprising or an upcoming movement in Bahrain.
This is what I want to ask you about, Mr. Ibrahim, in less than 2 minutes' time. You explained fully why it's not acceptable to take part in such elections, but what is the roadmap that the opposition can really take to stand in the face of what you call the authoritarian regime inside of Bahrain?
In 2012, there was a direct dialogue between the Secretary-General of the Bahraini Al-Wifaq Society, His Eminence Sheikh Ali Salman, with the king, and then with the crown prince. Sheikh Salman presented a roadmap that the king did not respond to, and then the situation worsened. Today we are in 2022, and after more than 10 years of direct dialogue, Sheikh Ali Salman has been imprisoned, the spiritual father Sheikh Isa Qasim has been deported, and now the opposition is abroad, and there is opposition inside. There was a proposal from the opposition that there should be a memorandum of understanding or direct dialogue with the government of Bahrain, with the king directly. The opposition wanted to resolve the Bahraini crisis through dialogue. This call now, after 12 years, was not heard from the regime in Bahrain. We believe that the crises are cumulative, because the political crisis has led to a human rights crisis, an economic crisis and a social crisis. Therefore, we expect that there will be an upcoming uprising for these reasons, because all calls are not heard. Neither the Human Rights Council is listened to, nor the European Union is listened to, nor the calls of the Western countries in Bahrain are listened to. Even any Arab initiative was not listened to. There is a complete rejection from the Bahraini regime, which does not want to solve this crisis. Therefore, we expect that there will be a new uprising to pressure the Bahraini regime.
So it seems that 2023 will be a very important year for Bahrain, for what the opposition might bring to the table. I want to thank you very much, Mr. Ibrahim Sarhan, legal advisor and human rights defender from Beirut, speaking to us about the so-called elections that happened in Bahrain last week. Thank you for your time. Thank you, and I'll see you again next week. Salam alaikum.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis-sabri was-salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear audience of IRIB English Radio, now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sayyid Asad Jafari.
Cultivating an Islamic identity has been our ongoing topic. The past few nights, we have been looking at some of those barriers, those mawani', those impeding forces that sometimes block us from achieving this desired identity. Look, Surah Ankabut has a very beautiful, powerful verse. Surah Ankabut is a Makki surah. And majority of this surah was revealed during the latter stages of the Makki movement. And as many of you know, those years were very tough on Rasulullah. Shibi Abu Talib banished, sanctioned, told to leave his own city. Very difficult time in those 3 years for the Muslims. Now during those times, I want you to imagine and the sha'an and nuzul, the reasons by which, or the events by which this verse was triggered, tells us that one of the groups that of course gravitates towards the Prophet are the young, as you know. And so these young guys now who are around the Holy Prophet in Shibu Abu Talib, an area outside the outskirts of Mecca that is really scarce in terms of resources, not all of their friends or their group or their circle now said labbaik to the Prophet's call. There were some who stayed in Mecca. There were some who simply didn't make that plunge into Islam. So now this group of theirs that they grew up with now is split into half. Half the group is in with the Holy Prophet. The other half of their friends are in the streets of Mecca. These are young guys. And so Tafsir says that a group of them approached the Holy Prophet and said, look, we have very close friends in Mecca. We know them since we were a child. Now they didn't have tawfiq to answer your call. But of course our hearts yearn for them, long for them. We haven't seen them in months, years. What do? I mean, we can't go there, and there's a crossroads here. a little bit of tension because we said labbaik to your call, and they're still, you know, they're still on their belief. And then this verse came about. If I'm not mistaken, it's verse number 8 of Surah Al-Ankabut. Allah now answers the Holy Prophet, or answers this group. It's a beautiful question. I think this is something that is faced by a lot of people, a lot of my young guys. They're part of groups, toxic groups sometimes, knowing full well there is toxicity in that group. And I know better not to be with these people. I have a tough time separating myself from them. I talked about the idea of the triggers of thought a couple of nights ago, and the circle you surround yourself in, of course, is one of those triggers. So now the verse, right? Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Inna alladhina amanu wa amilu salihat linudkhilannahum fis salihin. For the ones who have faith and the ones who do good. Amanu wa amilu salih. You have to have that condition. If you have that condition, Allah says, we will place you amongst the salihin. We'll find you friends that are just like you. We'll place you in groups that have the same goals as you, the same iman as you, to some degree, of course. You don't need to sit there and fight your conscience to please them. I think there's a lot of guys, a lot of my youth today, when they examine their circle of influence, they might be a little bit surprised to find out that I ended up with this group of people. I never thought maybe 10 years ago that I'd be spending my extra time with these people. But sometimes, you know, hearts kind of attract each other, right? God basically is saying that, look, tell them, Ya Rasulullah, that don't worry about loneliness. Don't worry about being isolated. Don't worry about being rejected. We will place you amongst groups. We'll find you friends. We'll place you with people that are just like you, salihin. لِنُدْخِلَنَّهُمْ There's two types of emphasis in this verb. The lam is emphasis. The shadda on the noon is also emphasis. Noon is thaqeel, it's called in Arabic. Meaning what? Hatman, saddar, sad, 1,000%. God says, we are the ones that will place you, دَخَلَا فِي الصَّالِحِينَ, with a group that is amongst the pious ones. Provided إِنَّ الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا وَعَمِلُوا الصَّالِحِينَ. Don't sell your soul out. A lot of guys out there who are surrounded by people, and they have to push that conscience down, quiet that voice down that's telling you this is not a good idea. This is not a good idea. You know better. You come from a very pious household. Your parents worked very hard to raise you, and they have to push it down. It's very tiring and exhausting to do that. And after a while, you end up losing respect for yourself. But the reason why they continue to push that voice down is because they don't want to be ostracized, isolated, called out, rejected. So sometimes the fear of rejection actually comes over and hijacks the voice of conscience. It's a strong, strong fear. So sometimes I think our sisters who want to start hijab in their life a little bit later on in their life, they have to stop and think, okay, my coworkers will see me tomorrow. My friends will see me tomorrow. How do I answer, for example, this person if I'm a business person, a businesswoman, my clients, my patients, if I'm a doctor, am I ready to face all of that? And if they are, I've seen it. Bismillah, they start. Because one discussion I'm going to have with all of you is this need to be distinct. This need to sometimes go a little bit away from the current. That, inshallah, is in a couple of days, maybe even tomorrow. We'll see how it goes. But tonight, however, we have to tackle this fear of rejection. Now, sometimes, and I'll give you my own example, okay? Sometimes, you know, there are people, and by the way, I always, always appreciate this. There are people who go out of their way to give me feedback on the lectures. Like, I find it to be very humbling when somebody goes out of their way, they're busy, they have kids, they have work, to message me in whatever platform they message me on, to just to say thank you very much. And they're very, very polite. They're very encouraging. Every so often you get the hate mail. You do. And, you know, things like, you know, that was an embarrassing set of lectures you delivered. Things like, you know, your approach is very misogynistic. It's very male-dominated. You say he too much. Let's say, for example, there's a whole group out there that are females. You assume only males hear you. Great feedback, by the way. It really is. Sometimes you hear things like your topic this year was not so great. Last year was better. Right? And sometimes so much so that, you know, people refer to me as half an alim because I don't wear an imam on the member. All these things come to my directly to my email, which is great. That's fine. Alhamdulillah. It's a really thick skin. Alhamdulillah, I have. Sometimes it's too thick. I have really thick skin. And sometimes, you know, it's the idea that, you know, I'll focus, and literally if I do it like 20 emails I get of feedback across, you know, 5-6 years, three of them will be a little bit negative. That's nothing. Otherwise, 17 emails changed my life because of you, all these, you know. And you would think that these three wouldn't have an impact on me. I'm a human being. If my focus becomes only the three emails, please follow this very carefully. If my focus is the fact, if I get really, really impacted by one person telling me, basically I rejected your efforts, didn't benefit, wasted my time. And I'm not, for example, putting the same amount of weight on those lectures that are the opposite in their feedback. Very generous in their words. Then after a while, I have to stop and ask myself, am I impacted by their words and their rejection? Or are they shining a light on my own individual rejection?
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karim Adi Ali.
Join us in this journey, IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
IRIB English Radio presents
Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
And God said, let there be light, and there was light.
The Creator made Adam in his image, then placed the world in his care. May you walk alongside the Creator in righteousness.
God of Abraham, take my child into thy hands, that he may live to thy service.
God has spoken to us before, through Abraham, Noah, Moses, and through Jesus Christ. Why should we be so surprised that God speaks to us now through Muhammad?
Viewpoint.
A critique of movies with religious themes on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Viewpoint on IRIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and my guest speakers in the studio, Sayyid Abdullah and Sister Asma. Sayyid Abdullah, assalamu alaikum, welcome to the program.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And Sister Asma, assalamu alaikum to you.
Wa alaikum assalam, happy to be here.
Well, we are very happy to have you back in the studio, criticizing the movie June, produced in 2021, directed by Denis Villeneuve. Let's take a listen to a short part of this movie June, and then we'll be back with his critique. Stay with us.
Desert power.
This is only the beginning.
Back to the program Viewpoint on IRIB English Radio. We are trying to criticize the movie June, produced in 2021, directed by Denis Villeneuve. Well, in this part of the movie, Sister Asma, Paul, the major character, says, my father didn't come to the desert for the spice or your riches. He's talking to those people, you know?
Yes.
But the pheromones, I guess.
Yes.
But for the strength of your people, right? My road leads onto the desert. And also at the end of the movie, he refers to this, you know? And Chani, basically played by Zendaya in the movie, you know? She says, this is only the beginning. What do they mean?
By the beginning, and my father wasn't coming here for taking the benefit from you.
Yes, and also if you imagine that, like if you see the end of this movie, June, that they see that they have harnessed the power of, for example, the sandworm.
Yes.
Right? So they called it the power of the desert.
Yes.
So, Paul was surprised at seeing it at first sight, you know, so
he himself was surprised.
He was surprised, and you know, but Chani, as one of the pheromones, the girl said, this is only the beginning.
Yes.
Right? It's like there are lots of things you need to learn about the desert.
Yes. Well, it's because the movie itself was an introduction to the upcoming sequels to that movie, because it is not the end, because just when the movie started to begin, they finished it. And it was just the introduction that we got. And when he says that my father didn't come here for the benefit of your land, he actually meant that they are going to come here from their utopia that they were living in order to bring peace with themselves. And they wanted to make use of those strong people who lived in there. With the use of those spies, those people who are living in that desert technically are going to be the most strong people in the world, because they are living in the hardest situations and they have creeds in those sandworms.
They developed a rough skin,
yes,
basically.
Yes, yes, yes. Exactly. So, and we see all the time he's been addressed as the savior. So this is going to be the start of his journey, since he's going to have the sand worms at his service as well with the people, with the Fremen. So he's going to create a strong army.
Right. And he also says, my road leads into the desert, onto the desert. Right.
So he has to take these people with him and go across this land in order to make peace.
I see. Okay. Thank you very much. Let's take a listen to another part of this movie, or a trailer of the movie June, produced in 2021, directed by Denis Villeneuve. And then we'll be back. Don't go away.
My planet Arrakis is so beautiful when the sun is low. Rolling over the sands, you can see spice in the air. The outsiders ravage our lands in front of our eyes. Their cruelty to my people is all I've known. What's to become of our world?
Back to the program Viewpoint on RIB English Radio with me, Mohammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sister Asma and Sayyid Abdullah, my guest speakers in the studio. We are still talking about or criticizing the movie June, produced in 2021, directed by Denis Villeneuve. Sayyid Abdullah, you know, I'm going to ask you about eschatology, basically. I guess that is your field of study, or maybe your cup of tea. You know, in theology and religious studies, well, this is what the definition goes or gives us: the study of the doctrines and beliefs pertaining to the end of the world. The doctrine pertaining to the end of the world, or the part of theology concerned with death, judgment, and destiny, or a branch of theology concerned with the final events in the history of the world or of mankind. Well, I searched this word in the Britannica Encyclopedia, right?
Yeah.
And it gives us this definition with its copyright.
Yeah.
Theological doctrine of the last things, or the end of the world. Mythological eschatologies depict an eternal struggle between order and chaos, and celebrate the eternity of order and the repeatability of the origin of the world. The most notable expression of mythological eschatology is in Hinduism, by the way, which maintains belief in great cycles of the destruction and creation of the universe. Historical eschatologies, however, are grounded in datable events that are perceived as fundamental to the progress of history. Judaism, Christianity, and Islam all have historical eschatologies. Eschatology in the Hebrew scriptures sees the catastrophes that beset the people of Israel as due to their disobedience to the laws and will of God, and holds that conformity to God's plan will result in renewal and the fulfillment of God's purpose. In Christianity, however, the end times are thought to have begun with the life and ministry of Jesus, the Messiah, who will return to establish the kingdom of God. Millennialism focuses especially on Christ's second coming and the reign of the righteous on earth. Right? In Buddhism, eschatological traditions are associated with the Buddha, Maitreya, and with Pure Land Buddhism, as well as with individual efforts to achieve nirvana. In Shiite Islam, it is believed that the Mahdi, or the restorer of the faith, will come to inaugurate the last judgment, in which the good will enter heaven and the evil will fall into hell. So, Al-Mahdi in Arabic, the divinely guided one, roughly translated at that. In Islamic eschatology, a messianic deliverer who will bring justice to the earth, restore true religion, and usher in a short golden age before the end of the world. So my question to you, is eschatology important to learn about? Sayyid Abdullah.
Is eschatology important? It is important for a person to know how things will end. I mean, as at least as a point of curiosity.
Mm.
I mean, I wouldn't say it's compulsory for everyone to learn, but if you want to know how the world ends, then you need to at least have a read about eschatology. And so you know, you have eschatology, you have etymology and cosmology.
Mm-hmm.
They all these three logies or studies, because logi means study, mm-hmm. deals with the last of days or last of time, or at least current present time. So it's important that one needs to know what's going to happen and how it's going to happen. And mind you, you mentioned like the Abrahamic religions. The fact is that this is not like exclusive to the Abrahamic religions. Even the Mayans, the Aztecs,
yes,
they also had their own epistemology in this
Eastern
regard.
Religion, as I read it from Britannica,
Buddhism. Yeah, so even non-Abrahamic religions, they also have their own vision.
Yeah.
Or at least not just the Messiah, they have their own vision of the end of the world. Even right. the Egyptians, for example, mm-hmm. they had their visions. So pretty much every civilization that existed, they predicted the end of the world in their own way, in their own form.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's worth a while.
Yes.
One needs to have a look. For example, if you look at an Islamic perspective, Islam gave a very clear image, even a vivid image of how things will end.
Yes.
Like even like pre Day of Judgment, Day of Judgment, and after Day of Judgment.
Mm-hmm.
Very vivid picture. So you just read and then you can just picture how things are going to get turned.
So we strongly urge our listeners actually to refer to those texts, right?
Exactly. So if you read the Quran, for example, the Quran talks about Day of Judgment, for example, what happens before Day of Judgment,
mm-hmm.
and how things will collapse, how the earth itself would unfold, how the mountains will vanish, how the seas will turn to fire, how the plants will collide with each other, how the skies will fall. So all this information is being provided to us.
Mm-hmm.
And even after, when it comes to Day of Judgment, even that is given to us. And even prior to Day of Judgment, that's also given to us.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Sayyid Abdullah and Sister Asma. We'd like to end this episode, finishing the whole critique of the movie June, produced in 2021, directed by Denis Villeneuve, by listening to, a description of Imam Mahdi by Dr. Chris Hewer, with a background in Christian theology, education, and Islamic studies, as well as interfaith studies. Thank you very much. And wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
If the world were left without the guidance of an imam, then it would go into chaos. So in some way that we can't really understand, the 12th Imam is still constantly exercising that function of guidance in the earth today. And the model here which is given is a useful one. We can see the sun, and then the sun disappears behind the clouds and is hidden from our sight. And yet we know that the sun is still present behind the clouds, even though we can't see the sun. And we know that the sun is still shedding the rays upon the earth, bringing warmth and bringing light, and thus enabling life to continue upon the earth. Without the presence of the sun, all life on earth would end. Without the presence of the divinely appointed imam, human beings would necessarily go into chaos and confusion. The 12th Imam is, at this stage, the hidden Imam, but also the Imam of the present age. He serves this function today. At some future date, we know not when, he will re-emerge from his occultation, from his hidden existence, and then he will be known once again by people upon the earth. Obviously, this is something for which the Shia Muslims will pray, that God may hasten the return of Imam al-Mahdi and bring that blessed day when he will be there in our midst and people can turn to him and receive his guidance in a direct way during this period that we call the end of time, leading up to the end of the world.
Chair defense of Iranian combatants.
A senior Iranian lawmaker has said,
contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
Recent efforts made by the U.S. and allies in West Asian region trying to sow discord among ethnic and religious groups in places such as Iran have had reverse results. Case in point, today in Iran, the Turks, Kurds, Baluchs, Arabs, Shiites, Sunnis, Christians and Jews have good relations among themselves and with the Iranian government. Even some groups that previously had some conflicts and differences with establishment that led to the recent unrest are today cooperating with it to find peaceful resolutions, despite what the US, Israel and Saudi Arabia desired. In their latest meeting, heads of the three branches of the Iranian government called on relevant bodies to act vigilantly in maintaining public order, security and tranquility across the country. The officials also thanked the Iranian people for contributing to efforts to foil plots aimed at creating crises in the country. In recent remarks, the American President Joe Biden encouraged anti-government protests, saying, "We're gonna free Iran. They're gonna free themselves pretty soon." According to international law, Biden's remark is indicative of blatant foreign interference. The Americans and other enemies sought to destabilize Iran by implementing the same plans as in Libya and Syria, but they failed. President Raisi was quoted telling the local media. "By contrast, Iranian cities are now safe and sound," Raisi said, promising retribution for the riots and vandalism the country had experienced lately. To take a closer look at what's actually taking place in different corners of Iran right now, stay with us on this edition of Iran Today. The streets of Tehran have been largely quiet as the Iranian government attempts to signal that life has returned to normal after a few weeks of protests and sometimes bloody riots. But if the streets are now quiet after the unrest, there are signs that there is a challenge taking place and heightening within the establishment itself about the management method of the recent events and socio-political solutions for the causes of the unrest. In another gesture apparently intended to show the crisis is over, the government says it will allow the citizen groups to hold rallies again in the future provided they meet strict preconditions. Under the law of the Islamic Republic, citizens have the right to public assembly so long as the rallies are peaceful and not against the values of the Islamic Revolution.
In this encounter with America, there are certain attributes that are fundamentally different from the many plans and programs that we had been facing since the victory of the revolution. In two or three words, these attributes can be defined. First of all, this is really an international war against the Islamic Republic. Secondly, this is a hybrid war in technical expression. It depends on information, organization, and expertise. The third attribute is the fact that this is a complicated war with interwoven elements.
So, despite the misrepresentation by the Western media and Persian-language opposition media outlets, normal life goes on in Iran. Shopkeepers go to their shops, students attend their classes. Many people haven't even encountered a single demonstration personally, but the Western-affiliated media makes it look like a revolution is going on in Iran. In such a way that if a person enters Iran from another country today, he or she would think that something is wrong. This doesn't match the description of Western media outlets.
As we speak right now, we are close to the Vanias Square, which has been one of the hot spots in the recent protests. If you were looking through the cyberspace lenses, most likely you would have felt the place was burning in fire. This is what media does, cognitive warfare, change of perception. If you look carefully, the Western media is making their people see us as they please. Another aspect of what they're doing is to make our people see them as they prefer. But what they've been concentrating on during the recent unrest is that our people see them and us as they please.
In fact, experience shows that the countries which are typically deemed turbulent and unsafe by the Western media, such as Iran, are often actually the safest and most remarkable ones. According to most tourism experts, Iran has some of the kindest and friendliest locals you could ever meet. There are so many social and cultural misconceptions out there, and Iranians are always trying to debunk as many of them as they can.
There is a tight and meaningful relationship between most of the provinces in the country that are made up of different ethnicity, culture, history, language, and living conditions. However, these people live under a single umbrella called Iran. They never put their Lor, Azeri, Baluch, Arab, Turkmen ethnicities higher than being an Iranian. And this is the reason for their unity and coherence. Also, Islam brings additional unity and coherence for them. Because of that, we have an annual event in the Islamic Republic called the Islamic Unity Week. And during this week, all the Sunni and Shia leaders of the country and the region gather together to prove that we are not for conspiracy or internal conflict. Our enemies want to undermine this very strength of ours.
Iran is an incredibly underrated country with an immense history, the beauty of its landscapes, the details of its stunning architecture, the hospitality of its locals, the unique villages that still hold on to their centuries-old traditions, and so much more rarely ever gets represented in the news. Tourists who have spent time in Iran commonly believe it should be on every traveler's bucket list. However, the beauty of Iran is rarely shown in the Western media. Sadly, it's always buried underneath scary footage that only reflects the world of politics, the kind of politics that's twisted enough to fit the interests of its antagonistic foes.
These incidents have created a great opportunity, in my opinion, things we haven't paid enough attention to in the past. The most important is the fact that we must pay attention to our youth. They were emotionally provoked with some issues to come to the streets. They should be taken seriously and respectfully. We might have overlooked them due to the corona years. The other opportunity is about our universities. The Islamic Republic, since its beginning, has insisted on political environment inside the universities. But now our universities are vibrant again. Officials are visiting them more frequently now, and a good dialogue is taking place there. We need to continue on this path to reach higher grounds of free thinking.
Despite the exaggerated news coverage of recent protests in Iran, one has to be cautious in interpretation of the events and prediction of the outcome. Perhaps for Iran, the path to democracy zigs and zags and sometimes moves in ways that some people think is forward and others think is moving back, or so. While some commentators have gone so far as to call the demonstrations a women's revolution, this seems to go too far, according to socio-political experts. Political scientist Patrick O'Neill identifies a revolution as a form of political violence and the public seizure of the state in order to overturn the existing government and the regime. The current demonstrations in Iran do not match these definitions, although people are chanting.